Rana Faruhar, my guest today, is author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business, Don't Be Evil, How High Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles, and just last year, Homecoming, The Path to Prosperity in a Post-Global World. She is also a global economic analyst at CNN and most prominently an associate editor of the Financial Times. The Financial Times is the premier business newspaper for Europe and much of the globe, and the publisher of the weekly news magazine, The Economist. The Financial Times has been a big deal since its founding in 1888. For over a century, it has been the flagship advocate of liberal capitalism, which we can define as a marriage of democratic elections and economic capitalism. The Financial Times is considered the most important source of business news in the world, with the Wall Street Journal as a rival, but a distant rival. And then in the 1980s, the Financial Times pioneered advocacy of neoliberalism to repeal a host of government regulations of business and then to promote complete globalization of investment, labor, goods, and services. That combination, repeal of business regulations and embracing world movement of just about everything, would bring us, we were promised, a resurgence of economic vitality as prices dropped and capital found its best and most productive uses around the globe. Neoliberalism was to be the messiah of neo-prosperity, and the Financial Times was its foremost prophet. It is striking, then, that Rana Faruhar, who has emerged as one of the sharpest critics of neoliberalism, has her journalistic home at the Financial Times. Perhaps it's a sign of the complicated times we live in. But enough of introductions, it's time for Rana Faruhar to speak for herself.
This is Wally Knox. Welcome to the Political Conversation.
So let's dive in. You wrote a superb book, Homecoming, just published in 2022, on the general theme, I would say, about the debate about leaving neoliberalism behind and turning to a new paradigm for the economy. And the book is packed with information. Lots of folks I talk to who are not in the DC circuit and plugged into these conversations, frankly, are a bit mystified by a lot of the terms. Neoliberalism, globalization, localism, financialization, and the terms swirl around folks' heads. I thought a productive way to begin would be to walk us into your view of those definitions. And an easy intro is, You have an interesting take on the origin of neoliberalism and how you define it. So let me just ask you that.
Okay, great. That is a good place to start. So you're right. Neoliberalism is used in a lot of different ways. It's used in economic ways, in political ways. It's used in some cases differently on either side of the Atlantic. There are historical implications. But the way that I use it and the way I defined it in my book is really by using the definition of the International Monetary Fund, which is in fact a neoliberal organization. And the way that they define neoliberalism is it's an economic philosophy, basically that came out of the Washington Consensus ideas that the global economy that the global economy would allow capital, goods, and people to travel across borders equally, and that those things would always land where they were most productive to do so. And that has really been kind of the governing assumption of globalization for the last half century. That's how the global trade system works. That's our assumption about the financial system. Assume policymakers anyway, that the world is flat, you know, to quote the Tom Friedman book of 2005, that we're all on an equal playing field and globalization is inevitable and kind of always a good thing. Now, my issue with this is that there's a flaw in that theory. And the flaw is that capital, meaning money, finance has always moved faster and further than either goods or people. So if you think about, you mentioned financialization as another very wonky term, and it's true, it is wonky, but it's actually kind of simple. It basically means that the financial system itself has become the tail that wags the dog of the real economy, right? And that's why you have a financial system that, depending on how you measure it, is either double to up to four times as large as the actual Main Street economy. That's weird. You know, that's not how Adam Smith would have imagined that our market system would work. Adam Smith being sort of the father of modern capitalism. So those two definitions are, I think, a good starting point.
Thanks for that. So, and walk us into the Clinton administration, which certainly seems to be key to America's wholesale adoption of a lot of these ideas.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things I look at in my book is the beginnings of the Reagan-Thatcher revolution, which is when finance was deregulated, but then the Clinton administration, which is when trade was deregulated. And that was a really big step because, you know, the 80s is often rightfully thought of as a period in which animal spirits were unleashed, global corporations from the U.S. Start to get bigger and bigger, financial systems grow. But I would say that the rubber of globalization meeting the road of Main Street America really happened in the 90s during the Clinton administration. And that's when you had things like NAFTA being inked. You had the movement of China towards the WTO, which happened, their entry happened in 2001. And I actually had a conversation about this topic with the late labor leader, Richard Trumka, who used to run the AFL-CIO. And this was an important kind of cognitive turning point for me because I went to speak to him about what the implications of some of these trade deals and the globalization of trade in general was going to be for U.S. labor. And he said that he had a discussion in the 90s with a Clinton policymaker. And he said, look, you know, I understand why you're inking these deals, but you know they're going to kill labor in the U.S., not just here, but in most developed countries. And what are we going to do about that? And, you know, what do you think? And he said that this policymaker said, well, we understand that that is going to happen. Don't worry. But eventually, wages are going to level out, leveling up, they often call it in economic circles. And everybody's going to be on an equal playing field. And in the meantime, you'll get a lot of cheap TVs and electronic devices. And Trumka said, well, how long is this leveling out going to take? And the policymaker said 3 to 5 generations, which says a lot about where we have come since the 1990s.
Can we just stop? So you didn't say 3 to 5 years or 3 to 5 decades. The policymaker literally turned to Mr. Trumka and said 3 to 5 generations.
Yes. And in fact, I was so surprised, I double-checked that fact 3 times with him. I just couldn't believe it. And we should pause on that for a minute because there's a couple of truths that are worth thinking about here. One is, frankly, the arrogance of the economics profession, which thinks that it can model the real world over the course of 3 to 5 generations. That is just kind of a mind-boggling assumption. It tells you how mathematical and kind of inhuman, in a way, the profession has become, which is a whole nother podcast. Don't get me started on that. But the other thing is that the policymakers weren't really thinking about the political economy. You know, they were thinking about, well, eventually wages will equalize, but they didn't think, well, what's it going to mean if the Rust Belt is hollowed out? If all the work in the Midwest and the Northeast goes to right-to-work states, if you start to get deaths of despair, if you start to get entire communities that are dying, literally dying, because of these trade decisions, and then that creates swing states that give us Donald Trump. And I grew up, frankly, in one of those, well, it's not a swing state anymore, it's hard red Indiana, but you know, my county as I was growing up was, I would say, very purple. But by the time I was writing this book, my county in Clinton County, Indiana, went 76% Trump for this very reason, because there was a felt experience from real people that elites on either side of the aisle, either Republicans or Democrats, were not really feeling them, were not understanding how these policy decisions were affecting them, and thus they started voting for more extreme candidates.
So one of the comments that's been made to try to put a context around this very complicated set of issues was done by Danny Roderick a while back, who posed something. He very cleverly put together what he calls the trilemma. And what Roderick means by the trilemma, correct me if I'm wrong, is that if you have three values, national sovereignty, the ability of a nation state to govern its own economic and social affairs, democracy within that state, and then the third value is globalization, so that you obtain a whole raft of strongly touted neoliberal benefits, you're going to have a real problem, because you can obtain two of those, national control, democracy, but if you reach for that third one, globalization, you can't do it. You can have two, but not three. And Donald Trump, in a sense, was the manifestation of Danny's theory, walking the planet Earth.
it's a great point. Dan, that's absolutely right. And Danny is one of the wise and rare economists who has really questioned our assumptions of how models work, rightfully so, and is continuing to do that. Trump, I mean, the thing about Trump that is just mind-boggling, and it still just amazes me, I think people are going to be writing about this for decades, is how this guy, who was the ultimate con man, I mean, he is like a Melville definition of the con man, was able to make that work for his advantage. Because what he did was he said to people, you know what, there's a back room back there and everybody's smoking cigars in it and making deals and they're not in your interest, and I'm going to open the door. Now, he opened the door and then he went right back in with the guys with the cigars. But nobody had been willing to open the door. And that played well in a lot of areas. Now, I think that the Democrats have done a good job since then of realizing what a terrible mistake they made in giving up the working class as the traditional base of their party. And I think focusing too much on race and identity in lieu of class, I think that those things are connected, those issues are connected. But I do think Joe Biden was a really a great candidate in this respect to fight back, because he's Scranton Joe. He had that experience, whereas Hillary Clinton did not.
Well, let's not dive straight into the Biden discussion for a moment. I'm really intrigued to hear you say, in your own words, your particular version of the alternative to the neoliberal paradigm. And you sketch in your book, with some detail, the paradigm you see. Is localism, is that how you would like to refer to it?
I think, yeah, localism, regionalism, the post-neoliberal world. The truth is that we don't have a completely new unified field theory for what comes after neoliberalism, and that's something that I think is okay. It's something critics often complain about, because, you know, they like the idea that you can't fight a theory without a new theory. But I would say that one of the problems with the old theory is that it was so deductive, it was so top down, it was so place agnostic, when in fact, if we've learned anything in the last 15 or 20 years, it's that place does matter. There are big differences in political economies and the way the U.S. and China work, or the way job creation happens in Austin versus Frankfort, Indiana. Place matters. So that's a starting point. The next thing that I would say about what I think will work better in terms of how to run an economy is you have to make sure that there's not too much of a gap between the global market system and national interests. And I think that that's what happened in the last 40 years, is that you got a market system that moved so far ahead of the national interests, not just of the US, but any number of countries. And you can see the results in everything from Brexit to nationalism in continental Europe to some of the extreme politics, even in developing markets. you just get a votership, and politics still happens at the level of the nation state, that looks around and says, wait a minute, this system isn't serving me. And so that's when you get these sort of dangerous moments where you might throw the entire baby out with the bathwater.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you make the point that the alternative to neoliberalism hasn't been fully fleshed out yet. What I was going to offer to you was the idea that we're living in a peculiar time in which the paradigm of the new era, the overarching generalizations, are fairly clear, and very much the kinds of things you've been sketching, and very much the things that Joe Biden has been sketching out for us on the national stage. We can get more into that. The exact details, not so much. We're still trying to learn how to implement that. That's the idea I was going to offer to you, is implementation is going to be the main struggle of the next couple decades.
I think that's right. And I do want to say, I think we're about halfway there, if not more. And let me tell you what I do think we understand now. Concentrations of power are problematic, be they at the corporate level or at the state level. And one of the things that neoliberal systems really favored was big. Big companies, big states. You know, you look, there was a wonderful piece of research that was done by the UN Trade and Development Council that looked at really what entities have benefited most from the wealth created in the last 50 years. And it's two entities, large multinational corporations and the Chinese state. And that is a reflection of this cheap capital for cheap labor bargain, which was very much part of the neoliberal Chicago school, you know, let capital go where it will, which generally means to the cheapest labor locations, bargain. And so you get multinational companies starting to outsource huge swaths of the industrial commons. And I call it the industrial commons, and that's a little bit of a pulling from Mariana Mazzucato, because guess what? We all funded it. You know, things like broadband, the internet, telephony, the railroads, go back as far as you want. These are things that were funded by the state. They were underwritten by the state, then privatized by the commercial sector, which is fine. But so you get companies taking that wealth, putting it, a lot of it, overseas. Jobs go abroad. You get, you know, the China shock research shows that China coming into the global trading system was a game changer. And I want to be careful, because I don't want to fall into the China stole our jobs trap. You know, we made a decision to run our economy on neoliberal paradigms that said, as long as share prices are going up and consumer prices are going down, everything is fine. And in that paradigm, it makes sense to move labor off the balance sheet, to marshal your capital, to send your supply chains to places where, you know, when a pandemic hits, you may have no idea what's going on, and you may not be able to get masks or drugs or, you know, in the case of Europe, energy or any number of things. But that's what our system encouraged us to do. And unfortunately, that's still incentivized in a number of ways by our tax code, by, you know, standards of corporate governance. But I think we do understand that monopoly power is a problem. Efficient systems, and I put that in quotation mark, because efficiency means, you know, move things to the cheapest place, have one supply chain. Efficiency is great until things break down, and then it's really bad. So we understand we need more redundancy. We understand increasingly that the challenge of the next 50 years is not just GDP growth, but sustainability and the negotiation of dramatic increases in inequality, which are destabilizing liberal democracy. So we understand the challenges. We have some of the solutions. I would say two of the biggest questions that I think are somewhat still needing to be sketched out are, what is a 21st century labor movement going to look like? I think unions are hugely important and have a place, but the new world is, value is going to live a lot in intellectual property. There's going to be a big changes in jobs that will be wrought by technology. And so we need to make sure that labor is getting a piece of the wealth that's being created, because I think otherwise you might have some of the existing trends put on steroids. So that's point number one. Point number two is this move from shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism is happening, and the Inflation Reduction Act is an important part of making it happen, but it's still a work in progress. We need to find out what the new metrics are. Share prices are a really easy metric, but what are the right metrics to think about taking care of labor, taking care of the planet? We're still working on that.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the one of the big Biden bills, because I do want to spend some time with you seeing what your personal view is of the Biden administration and where Biden fits in the whole neoliberal versus localism transition. Obviously, vice president to Barack Obama, he lived through maybe we can call it the last stage of full flush neoliberalism, and took office and has diverged from that in one way or another. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I really want to hear your view of it. But I just wanted to begin by pointing out how remarkably, it's almost as if we've had three Biden administrations in 2 years. They were very different administrations. There was the emergency administration that came in and said, we have a pandemic on our hands. We must spend a lot of money very fast and put it into people's hands. There was a second administration which said, that went really well. I'm going to take every idea that Bernie Sanders has offered and I'm going to put them into bills and recycle them again. That went really poorly. And then there was a third administration in which Biden, along with Joe Manchin and others, said, let's figure out what we can actually pass this time. And that was the Inflation Reduction Act, the Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS bill, etc. Watching that as an outsider, it's a bit confusing. What's your take on it?
Okay, so that's a fascinating way to hear you define the last couple of years. I would say that while I wouldn't maybe disagree with the factual description that you've laid out, I would say that that's more politics than policy. Mm-hmm. To me, the policy has always been utterly clear: work, not wealth. I mean, I think that phrase, which is just so clear, has been really underplayed and underexplored by the media. What does that mean? Well, for starters, he's saying, guess what? I'm not interested in building an economy based on asset price inflation. We're going to build an economy where we're actually going to try and raise wages. We're going to try and have a better mix of production and consumption. And we're going to think about that in everything from monopoly policy to the way we are doing trade policy to supply chains to subsidies for union workers to fiscal stimulus that was given out actually this time to consumers, not companies. Big difference from 2008. 2008, we bailed out companies. This time we bailed out consumers. And that is one reason why things are going so well. I mean, I honestly would not have predicted that the economy would be as robust right now as it is. And I think that it has to do with the policies of this president. And he was fighting a big headwind, which is 40 years of loose monetary policy and, you know, a kind of a just let the markets do best approach that both parties took advantage of by passing the policy ball to the Fed. That's still an issue. We can talk about that separately. But I do think that the policy has always remained the same. I think he has also started to recraft the narrative of the neoliberal era. So, and that takes time. Let's go back and remember, you know, the Reagan-Thatcher revolution didn't just happen overnight, right? I would argue it maybe started in 76 when Reagan was still governor of California and gave that speech about government being the problem at the party convention. I believe it was in 76. That sets a stage. It starts a new narrative. This work, not wealth narrative, and then some of the accompanying moves, like we haven't talked about the July 2021, I believe it was a 2021 executive order in which the president said, you know what, trickle down is over. I'm not interested in lowering consumer prices as a measure of well-being. I'm interested in a broader measure of well-being that looks at how citizens are doing, not just consumers, at how stakeholders from small businesses to the public sector to workers to multinational companies are doing. We're gonna do this in a more nuanced way, and we're gonna really look at corporate power in through all different lenses, not just price. So I think we're getting there, but you gotta realize that we're trying to turn a half century Titanic here. So I think this president will be remembered as one of the greatest in history, and certainly one of the most change making.
I actually agree with you on that, but I do have to caution that it's very much, this is me talking, at, you know, very much first steps. You look, for instance, at the massive bills that were passed in the third stage of the Biden administration, if my analysis makes any sense. And those were bills that amounted to almost $4 trillion in value. Inside that, there was definitely place-based investment going on. But the latest article I read from Brookings estimated that at about the $80 billion level. Now, $80 billion is pretty darn good, but you think about that in the overall national investment structure, it is a beginning. And the worst possible tragedy would be is if we got the idea that every few years we'll elect a Democratic president who in 2 years' time will invest $80 billion, and then we'll have a desert, and then we'll wait for the next oasis and invest in, you know, that's just not the way to go forward. One of the most encouraging things that I heard you discuss, actually, and others, is that the interest in industrial policy and moving beyond neoliberalism is not exclusive to the Democratic Party. Can you give us your take on that?
Yeah, for sure. And that is something that's very reassuring. So let's start by kind of defining what we mean by industrial policy, because as you started this podcast saying that these words are, they're sticky, they're funny, they're fluid, they're provocative. So industrial policy used to be a third rail term, right? I mean, I've been banging on about this for a couple decades. I remember doing, you know, DC events with Rob Atkinson, you know, in the 90s, and people were just like, what? Industrial policy? Doesn't that mean you're socialist? No, what it means is that the right hand knows what the left is doing, you know, which is pretty much what every other country, not just China, which the Chinese actually took a page out of the early revolutionary American book, sort of Hamiltonian approach to industrial policy. But it just means that you have a national strategy that says, we know that the markets are important and that they do a lot of things well, but some markets and some outcomes require a little bit of state nudging or thinking. And healthcare would be a great example of that. You know, I mean, just look at the healthcare market in this country. It is, you know, we spend wildly more than the number two nation in terms of spending per capita, which is Switzerland. We have dramatically lower outcomes. Everybody is upset about it. Well, that's because healthcare is one of these markets, if you kind of go back to Joe Stiglitz 101, that it doesn't always behave like the perfect market Chicago school theory would say that it should, because we're talking about your health. We're talking about your life, you know? It's the same way I'm thinking about another example. I'll just mention that, you know, perfect market theory, efficiency theory would say that when we're hiring a nanny, for example, that we should pay the absolute lowest price that we can get, that that is what rational man or woman would do. So I could go out on the street and find some teenager to look after my kid for $7 an hour, and that's what I would do. No, that's what no one does, because it's your child. So you go out, most people, if they can, and, you know, find the absolute best person and pay them as much as you possibly can for a good outcome. I bring these things up because they're examples of ways in which the state has a role to play in nudging policy. We are now at one of those pivot points where I think the state will have to nudge policy in a few areas. And that's because with China now in the global trading system as the number two largest economy, and certainly on a near equal playing field in terms of influence with the US, you have two fundamentally different systems. You have a free market system and you have a state-run system. And those things are different. And there is no way that quarterly capitalism that is practiced the way we have it in the US is going to be able to compete with a system that in which policymakers are thinking for 20, 30, 50 years in the future. So that doesn't mean that the US should start picking winners and losers. That's actually not even what China does. What it does mean is that we should think about what are the resources that we will need for a 21st century competitive economy. One of those things would be human capital, as the consultants like to say. That's a little bit of a belittling term in some senses, but people. We need, you know, most wealth in the 21st century will come from brain power. So we need to rethink education. We need to focus on things like the care economy, because healthcare will be one of the fastest growing areas. We know that. That doesn't mean we're going to go in and, you know, pull a Solyndra and you know, pick specific companies. And by the way, it should be said that Solyndra was something like 0.1% of the federal venture capital portfolio. So, you know, I don't even think Solyndra was that big of a deal, but you hear what I'm saying.
But it got 99.9% of the media coverage.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I mean, I'm serious about this. As an ally with you in the desire to see industrial policy flourish, it's what we have to be very careful of. The failures will be prominent.
It is. And, you know, it's, you can see that I'm watching very carefully to see how the Inflation Reduction Act plays out, because as you know, it's really a climate bill. It's about kind of trying to nudge and create carrots and sticks for companies that are doing and countries actually that are doing the right thing or the wrong thing around climate. You mentioned that this is a work in progress, the shift, and we're in the early stages. I think how IRA happens at the ground level is going to be crucially important. Do we put our incentives in the right place? Do we find smart ways to create the behaviors that we want without becoming too prescriptive and creating speculation or bubbles in the wrong areas? There'll always be some of that. That's kind of natural. I mean, you go back to, you know, the early part of the 20th century when the world was making the shift from horse and buggy to automotives. Everybody knew we were going to all be using cars at some point, but there were 800 car companies. Nobody knew that what the big three were going to be. So we need to incentivize the shift without becoming too prescriptive about who the winners and losers are.
Perhaps we could be a little more upfront with folks about the fact that we don't have all the answers. To be blunt, that mistakes will be made. I think back to how Franklin Roosevelt handled his first 4 years in office, being pretty darn blunt about the fact he was going to try stuff. And to everyone's astonishment, saying those words went over pretty darn well.
Absolutely. I love that you brought that up. I have often wished that Joe Biden would do, and maybe he will in the next 2 years, a kind of a fireside chat narrative of some kind. Maybe it's a podcast. Maybe it's, you know, I don't know what it is. But yeah, to come on and say, look, here's the narrative. Here's the shift we're making. And we are going to try stuff. And just as when the private sector tries stuff, some things will fail. But we think a lot of them will work. And at the very least, we will be setting the foundations as we did during the New Deal, as we did in the post-war era, with educational reform, we'll be setting the foundations for your children, my children, to do better than their parents did, which is the definition of the American dream.
I wanted to ask one more question of you, and it goes back to the thread in all of your work, and it goes back to the thread that Joe Biden has announced that it's work, not wealth. There's a faction within the Democratic Party that would say this is really all about money. There's too little money and too few in too many pockets, and too much money and too few pockets. We can solve that by universal basic incomes, transfers of major wealth amounts. You've written an enormous book about what a possible new paradigm, moving beyond neoliberalism, would be. And it sure didn't sound like that. You seem very interested in the work people do. And do they have good work? Do they have well-compensated work? But do they have work? Why is work important?
Well, you know, like Freud said, what's it all about? Work and love. You know, it's about work and love. And it's funny, I'm more and more looking at the world through a psychological lens because I think it makes a lot of sense. But I've always thought that, you know, people, and a lot of economic research shows this, people need to have meaning in their lives. You know, I mean, this is sort of part of the basic understanding of deaths of despair. The Angus Deaton and Anne Case research that came out of thinking about, you know, when the Soviet Union privatized, there was a group of men actually whose life spans went dramatically down, and it wasn't so much that they didn't have an income or a stipend or money. It was that they no longer had meaning. They no longer had jobs. They no longer had a place in the community. And I think you can take that and apply it as they did to many hollowed out parts of the U.S. that people can get jobs. I mean, they may not be great union jobs. They may not be as high paying as they used to be, but with two incomes, you know, families can do okay. But you have a group of people that have lost their connection to the community, that have lost a sense of I'm part of something bigger than myself. That then creates isolation. It leads to the sort of disintegration of relationships with children, with spouses, with the community. It's, you know, you start getting into the kind of bowling alone territory where people are just isolated and they get depressed and they die. I mean, you know, I think that one statistic that is not getting enough attention is the fact that our lifespan in this country, the average lifespan, has started going down for the first time in many decades. And I think we need to look very, very carefully at why that is. And I think it's about the loss of community and the loss of national purpose.
I am very glad you came on the political conversation to share your thoughts with us today. It's been an absolute joy talking to you. I'd love to invite you back to explore some of the ideas we haven't had a chance to get into.
Oh, I'd love to do it. Thank you so much for having me and for such thoughtful questions.
The obsession with globalizing everything was done in by its own arrogance. Rana Faruhar has the best description of that arrogance in her story about the Bill Clinton administration official who was asked in the 1990s how they would deal with the whipping American workers would take when trying to compete with workers around the globe who earned less in a week than Americans earned in an hour. "Don't worry," the official said, "it will all work out over time as the paychecks of the rest of the world caught up with the U.S., as world pay leveled up to the American level." And how long would that take? Oh, 3 to 5 generations. You will be driven out of a good-paying job, your children will never have a good-paying job, and the same for your grandchildren, but maybe your great-grandchildren will finally have well-paid work. Donald Trump had a very different answer. He would make America great again now, and he had an audience hungry to hear that someone was on their side for a change. Bill Clinton had promised endless prosperity from globalization. The actual result? Well, compare the economic lives of children born in 1950 and born in 1980. An economist named Raj Chetty at Harvard has calculated that for all the children born in 1950 who began their important earning years in the 1970s, 78% succeeded in earning more than their parents. They achieved the American dream. Of children born in 1980 and beginning their important earning years in the 2000s, barely half earned more than their parents. And that percentage of success continues to shrink. Today, we have an entire generations of Americans who know the American dream exists only for a smaller and smaller part of us. Those deeply disillusioned people will not permit us to return to illusions of the Clinton era. But we've not yet fully transitioned to a new era. We haven't fully exited neoliberalism. In your life, you'll see endless transformation, but the end state? Neither you, nor I, nor Rana Faruhar know just what it will look like. May you live in interesting times is said to be an ancient Chinese curse. The debates about the new era are just beginning. We're not in a period of coherence. We're in an era of debate. Here at the Political Conversation will be a forum where those discussions and debates can take place. Rana Faruhar is a superb debater. I do think one thing is clear about our era. The new era will bring tensions to many of us. Tensions for progressives, tensions for those of us in the center, and even for nostalgic neoliberals. For progressives, there may be particular difficulties because progressives insist that their views be grounded in morality. Progressives are outraged by the immorality of racism here at home in America, and they are outraged by the immorality of American foreign policy abroad, especially our failed military invasions. In the neoliberal era, those moral objections fit naturally into a broad anti-neoliberal stance on economic issues. An immoral American government fostered racism at home, invaded countries abroad, and on top of that, exported good jobs and crushed our middle class. Immorality was the key error in each case. If the coming era fulfills the vision of Faruhar as one of homecoming and a retrenchment from unrestrained globalization, it is not at all clear that those moral arguments will make sense. If the government is trying to foster local, well-paid jobs instead of taking a stance harmful to our workers, what will progressives say to stake out a distinctive stance? Of course, there will be lots of debate about which programs succeed and which fail. But those questions are all about what works best, what is pragmatic. Being pragmatic is the opposite of orienting your views around a striking moral imperative. In a pragmatic environment, what would there be distinctively progressive to say? If you are in the center of our politics, you will, like me, feel the tug of many conflicting arguments. Without a dogma being dogmatic, everything becomes a difficult decision. We'll have two problems. First, which overall paradigm should our nation be following? And second, what particular programs will fulfill that paradigm best? For instance, should we follow Faruhar's paradigm of localism? And if so, should the government strongly tilt the tax system to lure businesses out of the current metropolises into more rural areas? One way to deal with that quandary is to try different experiments and see what works. And the U.S., with 50 different states, is beautifully set up for the 50 states to become the laboratories for just such diverse experiments. For those with neoliberal nostalgia, I'm thinking here of the prominent commentator Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, there is serious worry that retrenchment from unfettered globalization could bring catastrophe. He recently wrote, quote, "It is possible, perhaps even probable, that the world system will shatter." Well, is it clear that the world system is showing signs of shattering? Personally, I have my doubts. The point of globalization was to boost the movement of investment, manufactured goods, services, and labor by wholesale junking any restraints on their movements. So what has happened? Let's just take a quick look at trade and at foreign investment. Back in 1980, the total export of goods and services around the globe was $8.4 trillion in today's dollars by my back-of-the-envelope calculations. By 2008, 28 years later, the total reached $27.3 trillion. Trade had more than tripled. Very rapid growth. But it hit the catastrophe of the financial crisis and recession of 2008. By 2021, total trade reached $30.9 trillion, and the rapid growth had become a slow crawl, not a collapse, but a crawl forward. Did the same slowdown take place in investments across national borders? In 1980, the total investment across borders was $53.4 billion. Foreign direct investment reached $3.1 trillion in 2007, an increase of 6,000%. But 2007 was the peak of foreign investment, which has not been achieved again since. By 2020, it had fallen to $1.4 trillion, more than cut in half. So put that together. In the era of neoliberalism, international trade and investment grew alongside each other. But now different things are happening to trade and international investment. The growth of trade has slowed, but the amount of cross-border investments has collapsed. Very different changes. Unfettered globalization is no more, but we are today a much more global economy than we were a generation ago. That's not going to change. Like I said a moment ago, we're in a deeply unsettled period, and no matter your personal outlook, our new era will require us all to adapt to it. Welcome to the new world. If you think the world is not fitting into easy stereotypes, that is a sure sign you're seeing things clearly. I want to thank Rana Faruhar for her fascinating insights. You can get a copy of her important new book, Homecoming, anywhere good books are sold, including your local bookstore. As always, I want to thank my producer, Anna Kumu, for her excellent work. My next interview will be with Rui Teixeira, the author with John Judis of The Emerging Democratic Majority, which for decades was a deeply misunderstood field guide on how the Democratic Party could, well, have an emerging majority. Now he has become the foremost friendly critic of today's Democratic Party. Be sure to listen in to what is sure to be a fascinating and unsettling discussion.